Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotzer coming at you live from Blue Ash and outside the Orange Spot, which is a new kosher restaurant here in Cincinnati. We're very excited about it. And even though there has not been, to my mind, any official announcement of opening the place, word of mouth has caught on among people in the religious community here in Cincinnati. There's a nice crowd in there, even though, you know, you'd never know how that, I mean, hasn't been any radio, TV, or newspaper announcement of it. It's fascinating. Well, welcome aboard, everybody. We're going to actually start from page 5 again, from the very top, here in our book club class, our Gulf Manor Synagogue book club class, and dedicated to Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's newly produced book, The Return to Zion, which are addresses that he gave over the decades about the importance of Israel, the return to Israel, ultimately the state of Israel, and so on. And so he speaks in January 1944, and I'd like to really start from the top. For those who may not have gotten it last week or didn't listen to last week's lecture, you'll hear the whole thing, hopefully, in its entirety. It's a rather long speech, but it's a real beauty. I haven't really finished reading it on my own, but I guess we'll do it together. Let's get started. This one is called The Parchment is Consumed, but the Letters Fly Free, delivered in January 1944. He says, Morai v'rabotai, gentlemen, I was asked to speak about the destruction of the Jewish people and of Judaism, a topic that requires a Jeremiah and a Baruch ben Neriya, each writing an entire book of lamentations, composed of multiple alphabetic acrostics, to do it justice. I cannot take up this topic. We are now living through a destruction that is unquestionably more extensive than those of the first and second temples, both in quantity and in quality. The admonition in Deuteronomy of 28, together with all the other plagues and curses not mentioned there, have been realized in their full gruesomeness and horror. We have lost the oldest and greatest Jewish centers. We have lost millions of Jews. We have lost the best and the finest that the Jewish people has to offer. Everyone knows this. There is no need to expound upon it. Reality itself supplies the most terrifying picture of the situation. Every newspaper and every report unfolds into a scroll of blood and fire. There's an age-old halacha found in Tractate Shabbat and in Ebel Zutarki. As a person was approaching death, they would say to him, confess before you die. Many who confessed did not pass away, while many others passed away without confessing. When an individual or a community finds itself or himself in a time of distress, in a moment of crisis, when the fate of the person or group in question will be decided, he or it must confess. The Torah concludes the admonition in Leviticus with mention of the ancient Jewish laws of introspection and confession. Quote, you shall perish among the nations, and the land of your enemies shall consume you. Those of you who survive shall be heartsick over their iniquity in the land of your enemies, and they shall confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers, in that they trespassed against me. Yea, they were hostile to me. Leviticus 26. A national admonition, a gruesome catastrophe, must close with confession. But I must make this distinguished gathering aware that even if the general conception of confession is connected with transgression, with a guilty conscience, with a sense of sinfulness and wrongdoing, the idea of confession is actually much deeper and more expansive. It plays a colossal role in modern philosophy, especially in the neo-Kantian school founded by Hermann Cohen. Hermann Cohen, the Jew, who, like other Jews of his time, unfortunately did not appreciate the ideal of loving and returning to Zion. Universal thought functions according to the laws of confession. Reality is constituted through self-reflection. Retrospective examination and consideration of the past are lofty gifts granted the human mind by the creator of the world. Two of the principal distinctive features in which, quote, the superiority of man over beast, see Ecclesiastes 3, is manifest. If that is true of human consciousness in general, it is especially characteristic and typical of us Jews who have never considered the present moment to be the final goal, the objective of objectives. We Jews, who have lived for thousands of years with a chronological distinction between Bazaman Hazeh, nowadays, and La'atid Lavo, the messianic future, and who gave the world the concept of the end of days, also bequeath the Song of Moses. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of ages past. Deuteronomy 32. For one cannot contemplate the future from the perspective of the present. One must do so from the point of view of the past. In Brachot it says, all blessings recited in the temple would conclude Min Ha'olam De'ad Ha'olam, from eternity to eternity. When Jews standing in the temple would say, blessed are you, Lord our God, King of Ha'olam, the world, they would immediately explain what they meant by Ha'olam, not a small world of the present, of this moment, of diminutive, egotistical aspirations, of death and extirpation, but a great, unending future world leading to the vision of the end of days, eternity. They would therefore conclude, Min Ha'olam, the Ad Ha'olam, from the eternal past into the eternal future. That is the Olam of those recited blessings in the temple. And that is the Olam over which the God of Israel reigns. This concluding phrase would be added in order to counter the claim of the Sadducees that, quote, only this world exists. See Rashi to Brachot 54a. A world of the present, of the moment, of the passing, disappearing instant. No eternal future can be built in the future without introspection, immersing oneself deeply in the eternal Israel of the past. Confession involves retrospection toward the past, perspective on the present, and vision for the future. Especially during such a time of distress, an hour of divine wrath and anger, when providence is, as if one could say this, a lurking bear to me, a lion in hiding, Lamentations 3, you must certainly fulfill the aforementioned halakha. They would say to him, confess. Confessing does not mean wailing or rending one's garments. It is not synonymous with mourning. Confessing instead denotes a deep appreciation of the tragedy, a recognition of our current situation and troubles from the perspective of the past. Confessing means interpreting them as a visionary would, using future-oriented concepts and ideas. We have no reason to fear an honest confession. Many who confessed did not pass away. The prophets would very often confess, and still, they succeeded in transforming the Knesset Yisrael into an eternal nation. Many others passed away without confessing. Many modern Jewish movements have died out and vanished without having confessed and without having considered Jewish problems from the standpoint of Min Ha'olam V'Ad Ha'olam. In the merit of our confession will we live. See Evel Zutarty. Our healing and salvation depend on confession and introspection. And if, Morai V'Rabotai, confession is a mitzvah incumbent upon all Jews, then surely we Orthodox Jews are obligated to confess during such a time of destruction and distress. We must confess twice or even fully three times. You know, of course, that in the past, a single confession on Yom Kippur sufficed for plain Jews. The Kohanim had to confess twice, and the Kohen Gadol three times. Regarding the verses, quote, when the plague was over, the Almighty said to Moses and to Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, take a census of the whole Israelite community from the age of 20 years up by their ancestral houses, all Israelites able to bear arms. See Numbers 26. Our sages, as cited by Rashi, say, this is comparable to a shepherd whose flock was attacked by wolves. He counts them to determine how many survived. The Midrash Tanhuma and Yalkut Shimoni record the same idea, but in those sources, the text reads, how many are missing, instead of how many survived. Everybody, please jump in, ask anything you like. Otherwise, please, I beg you, kindly mute yourselves. Thank you. These two textual variants reflect two perspectives, two methods of approaching a terrible, gruesome plague. One, the first method seeks to establish how many are missing, to calculate the loss, to portray the misfortune in terms of its horror, rending garments over the nation of the Almighty who had fallen by the sword. See 2 Samuel 1. Such a count is an act of mourning, grieving, lamenting, despair, and despondency. Such a census echoes with the ancient melody of Eli Tzion V'Arar, which of course is Tina number 45 on Tisha B'Av, the dirge of destruction. Two, the second method seeks to investigate how many remain, how many were saved, or can still be saved, so that the shepherd can assemble a new flock. This is not a count of despair or hopelessness, but a census of determination and firm, unshakable resolve, a fiery faith and burning belief. The first count is the cry of, he is a lurking bear to me, a lion in hiding. The second is that of, but you, O God, are enthroned forever. Your throne endures through the ages. See Lamentations 5. The second method is that of confession. It's interesting to note that when the Torah ordered that the Jews be tallied, it used the expression se'u, a census of the whole Israelite community. Not sefru, count, but se'u. Se'u can denote counting, raising, or carrying. The word can therefore be translated not only in the sense of taking a census, but also with the meaning of elevating, encouraging, and inspiring. The census commanded by the Torah must be one of firm faith and ecstatic hope, not of despair and despondency. When the plague was over, even though the mood was deeply mournful, they had to raise their heads. All Israelites able to bear arms. Whoever could fight, whoever had courage, whoever could prosecute God's war, count an army of proud, bold, brave Jews who stand with their heads held high. I think that today I will use the second method, the census of how many survived, and we will count in the sense of se'u, with the ancient halakha of confession, the idea of min ha'olam, v'ad ha'olam. To characterize our situation in exile, a few words from Nehemiah will suffice. Hanani, one of my brothers, together with some men of Judah, arrived, and I asked them about the Jews, the remnants who had survived the captivity, and about Jerusalem. They replied, the survivors who have survived the captivity there in the province are in dire trouble and disgrace. Jerusalem's wall is full of breaches, and its gates have been destroyed by fire. Nehemiah chapter 1. These words ring in our ears, not as echoes from over 2,000 years ago, but as the sounds of the living present today in 1944, as the din emerging from the commotion of the city. See Yuma 20b. We must, however, make one change to Nehemiah's words. Instead of Jerusalem's wall, read the walls of Warsaw, Berlin, Hamburg, Leipzig, Amsterdam, ancient, deeply rooted Jewish communities. The innuendo of the reference to quote, the Jews, the remnants who had survived the captivity, is immensely upsetting. This verse speaks only of the remnants who wallow in the concentration camps, who hide in the forests of Poland, in the marshes of Polesie, and in the steppes of Ukraine. Those who were slaughtered and poisoned are hinted at via the gruesome allusion to the survivors. The verse itself treats only the Jews, the remnants who had survived. But in the entire frightening picture that emerges from Hanani's cryptic report, one element stands in high relief: the gruesome tragedy of our modern times, just far more terrifying and dreadful than similar tragedies and catastrophes in previous centuries, not only from the quantitative, but also from the qualitative standpoint, highlights one phrase in particular: and disgrace, shame, humiliation, scorn, disdain, and so on. Even our good friends and companions look down upon us with contempt. This is a specific characteristic feature of our modern catastrophe. My friend Mr. Leon Gelman always emphasizes that not only is the destruction itself tragic, but so is the aloneness of the Jew, the sense that, alas, lonely sits the city, Lamentations chapter 1. This is certainly true, but aloneness is not a new phenomenon in Jewish history. It is an ancient curse or blessing that has always accompanied the Jewish people. Lo, it is a people that shall dwell alone. See Numbers 23. In the Middle Ages, we were just as alone as we are today, though the few good friends we had then were more loyal than our modern friends. The specifically modern aspect of the world's relationship with us nowadays is its contempt, derision, and disgrace. They do not respect us, reckon with us, or pay us any mind. We are regarded simply as irksome pests and idlers. Our best companions among the nations of the world show us not rachamim, compassion, an elevated concept that's connected with love, but only rachmanut, pity, the old rachmanut mentioned in the prayer for the government. From a psychological perspective, one can distinguish between two types of hatred. One, hatred deriving from jealousy, sometimes from a feeling of foreignness and otherness. Two, hatred deriving from a sense of contempt, disdain, and scorn. For we have become an object of scorn and derision among the nations. We are regarded as sheep led to the slaughter. See the Tachanun on Mondays and Thursdays. These are two separate curses, and both are on display today. Spinoza speaks of amor dei intellectualis, intellectual love. One can also speak of intellectual hatred, hatred deriving from an act of debasement, contempt, considering the other to be of lesser value than me. The hatred emerging from the verse, and we look like grasshoppers to ourselves, and so we must have looked to them. Numbers 13. The Gentiles could have thought whatever they wanted about the medieval Jew of yesteryear. They could have despised him with all their senses. One thing, however, is clear: that deep down in their hearts, they respected the Jew. Everybody, please mute yourselves. Thanks so much. One thing, however, is clear: that deep down in their hearts, they respected the Jew and they feared him. The Jewish God inspired trepidation and awe in them. They loathed the Jew on account of his differentness, isolation, stubbornness, strength of character, mysteriousness, and secretiveness. They believed that the eternal Jew bears God's curse, but at the same time they cowered and trembled before him. This synthesis of hatred, jealousy, and respect for the Jew runs like a golden thread through all of Gentile literature, from Apion and Tacitus, through church fathers like Tertullian, to Shakespeare and Goethe. It is no coincidence that when Jacob, the classical wanderer, swore by the God of his father Isaac, with whom the exile began, Jacob referred to God as Pachad Yitzchak, the fear of Isaac. See Genesis 31. Modern antisemitism, however, has shifted away from its belief in the eternal Jew, though in a negative direction, not a positive one. The Jew has not achieved equality, but has been diminished in Gentile eyes. Modern Jews were too quick in revealing to the Gentile that which our sages refer to as their secrets. Simchas Tanhuma. The mystery of our existence. Indeed, we left the tents of Jacob and the dwellings of Israel for the public domain. We gave up our spiritual isolation, our individual religious persona, our particular soul, and blended ourselves spiritually, smoothing out all the wrinkles and concealed facets of our inner being. The Gentile knows us. He sees that we are neither more elevated nor lowlier than him. On the face of it, this is a good thing. The trouble, though, is that once our specifically Jewish persona disappeared, he began to deride and scorn us. To the Gentile, there is no greater or better object of ridicule than the image of a cowardly, servile, dandy Jew who twists himself into a pretzel for the Gentile. A third of our people has been exterminated. Hundreds of thousands of Jews are in captivity, and the survivors, the free Jews, live in disgrace. There's that word again. How beautifully did Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi put it in his Gedolim Maaseh Hashem, in Maaseh Avot, chapter 33, and Rabbi Isaac Nissenbaum cites him in Hagut Lev, though I'll formulate the idea in my own words. In Genesis 32, it says, Jacob spent the night there, that dark and bitter night of the medieval exile in the ghettos of Germany and France, Poland, Lithuania. He selected from what was at hand an offering for his brother Esav. And this offering was the only weapon that Jacob used in the struggle with his brother Esav. And when he urged him, he accepted. See Genesis 33. How many persecutions were averted on account of this offering, and how many pogroms did Jacob prevent through bribes? But what was it that Jacob sent his brother Esav? 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milch camels with their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 she-donkeys and 10 he-donkeys. See Genesis 32. He selected from what was at hand. Precious stones and pearls, exactly. But everything was taken, as Rashi emphasizes, from the mundane, not from the sacred. If a Jew had to present Esav with an offering, he would draw upon his personal property, the possessions that he had acquired by the sweat of his brow, his he-goats and she-goats, his precious stones and pearls. He would offer these with humility and submissiveness, with obeisance and prostration. He would remove his hat. He would kiss Esav's hand, address him as sir, and once again, dance a servile dance for him. But as soon as Esav asked the Jew for that which was not mundane, but sacred, the hallows of Israel, his inner life, his relationship with God and his Torah, his Shabbat and sanctified family life, and so on, that same servile Jew, that poor tavern keeper or grimy country bumpkin, would in an instant transform into a Prometheus, a mythical figure. He would cover the nobleman's face in spittle and respond with pride and dignity from the mundane, not from the sacred. For what are you being executed? They would ask the coarse, crass country bumpkin. For not having violated Shabbat? For what are you being stoned? They would ask the boorish, wild, uncultured tenant farmer. Having taught my children Torah. For what are you being hanged? They would ask the grimy primitive peddler for not having prostrated before an idol. See Vayikra Rabbah, section 32. Quote, he instructed the one in front as follows. When my brother Esav meets you and asks you, whose man are you? Where are you going? And whose animals are these ahead of you? You shall answer, your servant Jacob's. They're a gift sent to my lord Esav. And Jacob himself is right behind us. End quote. to Genesis 32. Jacob would tell his agents, his intercessors, who had come into contact with Esau, with the kings of France, the Kurfürsten, the electors of Prussia, the Rabiovi, the counts of Poland, and the Knyazi, the dukes of Russia. When you meet Esau and he asks you, who are you? Where are you going? And what is all of this? In other words, when Esau starts speculating and philosophizing about your future, your fate, the solution to the Jewish question, answer him sharply and curtly. Esau, if you're interested in my money, in the earthly treasures that I possess, in my precious stones and pearls, in the goats and sheep, then what is yours is before you. They are a gift sent to my lord Esau. But if you have your eyes set on my soul, my future, my hopes and destiny, the fundamentals of my religion and faith, if you ask, whose man are you? Where are you going? To whom does this person, this soul belong? And in which direction are you headed? Then I answer proudly, your servant Jacob's. I belong to a different world, to Yisrael Sava, Israel of old. And no force on the planet can tear me away from the ideal of Min HaOlam, the Ad HaOlam. That is what the servile Jew who kissed the nobleman's hand would say. Such a Jew was despised, but was also respected and mysteriously feared. How miserable do modern Jews appear by contrast. Those cultured Jews with their smooth tongues and refined manners, with all their luster and shimmer, who, however, are cowards and sycophants. They have not learned the simple words of Rashi from the mundane, not from the sacred. And very often, they desecrate the hallows of Israel in order to curry favor with the nobleman, with Esau. In a word, the Yisrael Sava type, the old-time Jacob, who adopted an original method in his dealings with Esau, has all but disappeared. And if the typical Yisrael Sava had required protection already before the present catastrophe, now, with the destruction of Lithuania and Poland, the problem has become very timely. Many traits and markers of Yisrael Sava were preserved among Polish, Lithuanian, and Russian Jews, with their thousand-year-old histories and traditions, with their entire manner of living, thinking, and feeling. The seal of Israel was impressed upon all of their creations and accomplishments. They had the enthusiasm of Yisrael Sava, the strength of character in certain respects of our old-time Jacob, the image of whose countenance is engraved upon the throne of glory. See Bereishis Rabbah 68. With the destruction of Eastern European Jewry, this type is largely gone. And this constitutes one of the greatest tragedies of modern Jewry. A long time ago, as the Romans were burning Rabbi Hanina ben Taradion while he was wrapped in a Torah scroll, intending to annihilate him both physically and spiritually, Rabbi Hanina proclaimed, "The parchment is consumed, but the letters fly free." See Gemara Avodah Zarah 18a. My spiritual persona cannot be annihilated, cannot disappear. The letters will stay alive and fashion a new world. Today, however, I fear that a different passage of the Gemara, Moed Katan 26a, which stands in direct conflict with Rabbi Hanina's words, is applicable. And this passage is actually codified as a halakha by Maimonides. Quote, over a burnt Torah scroll, one must rend his garments twice, once for the parchment and once for the text. See Hilchot Avil 9. It seems that the Gemara held that Rabbi Hanina ben Taradion's response is not always valid. There are moments when we cannot be so optimistic, when not only the parchment, but also the letters, not only the body, but also the spiritual persona of Yisrael Sava are consumed. And today, tragically, the halakha of dual rending has become operative. We, who are mourning the Jewish masses who have fallen by the sword, must tear twice. Once for the parchment, the cedars of Lebanon, people of piety and good deeds, men, women, and children who all died in sanctification of God's name. and a second time for the text, the persona of Yisrael Sava, with every house incinerated in Warsaw, Vilna, and Krakow. Not only was Jewish property destroyed, but a tent of Jacob disappeared. And who knows whether one can enthusiastically exclaim about our American Jewish homes, Matovo Olech Yaakov, how fair are your tents, O Jacob? See Numbers 24. With every Jew shot by the Nazis, may their name be blotted out. A representative of Yisrael Sava, a reflection of the throne of glory, disappeared. With every Torah scroll burned, its letters went up in flames. And while all appreciate the gravity of the destruction and incineration of the parchment, few comprehend that of the burning of the letters. In the meanwhile, we have yet to see that the letters can cross the Atlantic. The absence of Yisrael Sava has begun to make itself felt not only among the Orthodox, in their societies for the study of the Mishnah and Ein Yaakov, in their observance of Shabbat and Kashrut, in their education systems, but also among other groups that have long fought against Yisrael Sava. The Yiddish press, especially the radical press, is suffering from a lack of leaders. Secular Yiddish works go unsold. They are peddled around like wide circulation books in the inventories of the itinerant booksellers of bygone times. Shalom Aleichem schools are closing. Members of the workman's circle are dying out, and no one is replacing them. The Zionist Organization of America laments its dearth of young people. The Yiddish theater employs actors who should have long ago taken up residence in old age homes. Why is all of this so? Because there is no Yisrael Sava. And even those who spat in Yisrael Sava's face had ultimately drawn their nourishment from him. Genesis 21, quote, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would suckle children? Says Rashi in the name of Chazal, what does it mean, children in the plural? On the day of the feast, the noble women brought their children with them, and Sarah nursed them. End quote. Old Mother Sarah, the mother of Yisrael Sava, along with her carbon minchas siddur and her tzenu arena, were responsible for sustaining and nourishing not only Isaac, Abraham's heir, but also the offspring of the noble women, the aristocratic dames, who had screamed hysterically that Sarah is barren, sterile, cannot have children. These noble women, these elegant dames, secular Yiddish literature, reform, the socialist movement, formalistic Hebraism, all of whom had scorned Sarah and Abraham, were, poor things, reduced to relying on Sarah's milk. And when Sarah stopped nursing, they all grew weak. Of late, the monthly Die Zukunft held a symposium in 1942 to 1943 on the question of the Jewish future here in America. I must admit that Die Zukunft and its affiliated radical circles have approached this whole complex of questions rather earnestly, despite the fact that they are ideologically as distant from me as East is from West. The main issue was, with the destruction of Eastern European Jewry, a type, a particular spiritual persona, has disappeared. How can such a type be recreated here? Of them all, Menachem Boreisha diagnosed the problem best, though he did not call it by its name. He wrote in Yankiv in America, Die Zukunft, July 1943, the question is, can Yisrael Sava be transferred to the other side of the Atlantic, or does he suffer from seasickness? Anyone who followed the symposium would have noted something strange. In the debate, you could see how earnest thinking people, much more earnest than the Hebraists, accused us, as usual, of having a penchant for Talmudic casuistry and hair-splitting distinctions. In truth, we followers of the halacha do not split hairs. Our scholarship is based on firm, logical foundations. And when it comes to political and cultural questions and problems, we take a healthy, realistic view. The true casuists are the stewards of secular Yiddish or even Hebraist culture. Their hair splitting is extremely similar to the outmoded casuistry practiced in Poland by Rabbi Jacob Pollack and in Regensburg, in which vein I once read a thorough investigation of what blessing primordial Adam recited over the fruit of the tree of knowledge. The representatives of secular culture do not wish to reveal the truth, and they strive with all sorts of ingenious arguments to suppress what they know and to confuse their readers. The typical Jew, as imagined by the men of the Zukunft, and here I include Hadorah as well, cannot exist in America. A Jew who has nothing to do with Abaye and Rava, a Jew who has no relationship with sanctity or with Min HaOlam V'Ad HaOlam, a Jew whose particularity consists only in typical isolated secular Yiddish or Hebrew culture, even if it is accompanied by a bit of sentimental or ceremonial religiosity. Quote, Lo Haya V'Lo Nivra, it never existed and was never created, but is simply a parable. See Gemara Baba Vashas 15a. America, though, is a real country that detests parables. In Poland and Lithuania, the secular Jew would suckle from Mother Sarah at home, in cheder, in his Jewish environment, and on the Jewish street. Such a Jew would never have been nourished by a secular mother. If the mother were not Sarah, then her son would, in most cases, not even be an irreligious Jew. A certain Jewish reader from South Africa, a rebellious sinner who had not yet forgotten the taste of velocious he would eat on Yom Kippur, spoke the truth. Yiddish culture can only exist in a ghetto, not in a free country. What then? One must place one's hopes in anti-Semitism. But Morai Rabotai, the truth is that Yisrael Sava can and will exist on the American continent and everywhere. And we will only have to rend once for the parchment, not a second time for the letters as well. The letters will, in fact, fly free. They will cross the Atlantic, seas and deserts, arrive in new communities, and there fashion a new Yisrael Sava. But which letters will waft through the air? Not the letters of the General Jewish Labor Bund in Poland, not the letters of Isaac Leib Peretz or the Association of Jewish Writers and Journalists in Warsaw, not the letters of the secular Yiddish schools, not even the letters of the Zionist Hebrew language Tarbut schools. Rather, the letters of Rabbi Akiva, the letters of the written Torah and the oral Torah, the words emerging from the mouths of schoolchildren, the eternal tradition which defeated Titus, Hadrian, the Crusaders, and Khmelnytsky, or Yimach Shemam. Those letters will float overseas and create new worlds. The Yisrael Sava of Abaye and Rava can make his home in any country, whether in a ghetto or in a free society. The secular cultural Jew can only survive in a ghetto. He has no place in the wider world. A female Yiddishist activist who later lived for many years in Western Europe noted to me that the ideals of the Jewish culture are wonderful on the roads of Vilna or Zavalna or Poholanka streets. But the moment they encounter the vastness of European culture, they grow pale and worthless. This is not some type of esoteric doctrine. It is very simple, almost elementary. Culture is not only something one knows, but also something one values, esteems, loves, and holds dear. It is not so important how much of my culture I'm familiar with. Much more significant is the degree to which I cherish my culture. Emotional connection is the hallmark of a cultured man. A person roots himself in a culture, enjoys life in it, serves it, loves it, and values it. I can be an expert in any number of cultures, but can only plant myself in the culture that I admire most, the one that I respect. If I do not consider that culture to be the highest, sublimest, loftiest one there is. It cannot exert any influence on me. People speak of cultural pluralism. Yes, a person can be well-versed in many cultures, but he can only bow to one. Cultures, like all values, compete. And Moraiva Rabotai, even with all of my respect for secular Jewish culture, I must tell you the truth. It cannot rival the powerful Gentile cultures, neither in quantity nor in quality. As much as I might esteem Chaim Nachman Bialik, my favorite poet, and as much as I might regard Peretz and others for the younger generation, they cannot match up to the greatest and best of Gentile culture. Our youth do not know the foundations upon which secular Jewish culture is based. They're not familiar with Bialik's Hamasmid, nor do they understand its yeshiva students' love songs and laments. They're not overly impressed by Shaul Chernyshevsky's paganism, and they do not know either Shalom Aleichem's Tevye the Dairyman, or Peretz's Mendel Brainus, Yochanan the Teacher, or Buncha Schreg. For them, these are dead characters from a dead world. Second, culture connotes continuity, history, tradition. And how long is the history of secular Jewish culture? With whom does it start? Can it speak from the standpoint of Min HaOlam Ve'ad HaOlam? Yes, the Jew who sits himself down on a beautiful Shabbos summer eve following Mincha and begins singing a somber melody full of yearning for the Shabbos queen as she departs with the setting sun and reads Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, Moses received the Torah at Sinai, see Avot chapter 1, has publicly demonstrated the perspective of Min HaOlam, the Ad HaOlam, from Sinai to the end of days, not the secular Jew. Yisrael Sava can coexist and compete with the greatest accomplishments of Gentile culture, Abaya and Rava, an egg born on a festival, see Be'er chapter 1, an ox that gores a cow, see Bava Kama chapter 5, can go toe-to-toe with Aristotle and Plato, with Dante and Shakespeare, Goethe and Schiller, and so on. For Yisrael Sava has the perspective of Min HaOlam, the Ad HaOlam. Eternity is always mightier than transience. It seems, though, that the absence of Yisrael Sava is apparent not only in the spiritual realm, but also in the political life of the Jew. Jewish political leaders have suddenly begun noticing that the nations of the world have more respect for Yisrael Sava, for the Jew whose greatness is his holiness, for the traditional Jew. It is no accident that beards and kaftans descended upon Washington, D.C. during the Rabbi's March of October 6, 1943. Our elegant national committees and political intelligentsia seem to feel that what Yisrael Sava can accomplish among Gentiles, a modern Jew cannot. This, too, is a good development. They will stop laughing at Choni HaMa'agel, Choni the Circle Maker. A welcome change. See Titus 23a. It's my understanding that one of the goals of this conference is to demonstrate the unity of Orthodoxy regarding political issues. It appears that the modern Jew is a victim of the same tragedy suffered by the mighty Samson when he, inebriated and lulled by Delilah's professions of love, revealed the secret of his strength to the seductive Delilah. Quote, no razor has ever touched my head, for I've been a Nazarite to God since I was in my mother's womb. If my hair were cut, my strength would leave me, and I should become as weak as an ordinary man. See Judges 16. Wrapped in a state of delight and pleasure on Delilah's knees, he lost the crown of his head. Quote, she lulled him to sleep on her lap. Then she called in a man, and she had him cut off the 7 locks of his head. Judges 16. It, quote, it shall remain consecrated until the completion of his term as Nazarite of God, the hair of his head being left to grow untrimmed. Number 6. And when Samson sobered from his intoxication, he discovered two things. First, the Philistines' manner of relating to him had not changed. She cried, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. The seductive Delilah continued ridiculing him. And second, quote, for he did not know that God had departed from him. Samson could no longer perform the trick of pulling the tendons apart as a strand of tow comes apart at the touch of fire. See Judges 16. No holiness, no seven locks of his head. Now he was hopeless and despondent. The modern-day Delilah, false, seductive European culture, with its assurances and its coquetry, with its professions of love and its secretiveness, has lulled his soul Saba to sleep, duped him into divulging his secret, shaved off his mysterious hair, which had connected him with the past and with the future, and begun tormenting him. In their encounters with Gentiles, the leaders of the secular Jewish movements can sense that the seven locks of his head are missing. All of them, including the Zionist leaders, have, on Delilah's knees, lost those seven holy mysterious locks. And without them, quote, his strength slipped away from him. He awoke from his sleep, thinking he would break loose and shake himself free, as he had the other times. For he did not know that the Almighty had departed from him. Judges 16. The movement to return to Zion, in particular, must possess the seven locks of Samson, for it faces a great battle. And who will rediscover this mysterious hair, if not us, the representatives of Orthodoxy? We must not fool ourselves. We should not expect any sort of sudden salvation or comfort to come from the nations of the world, even after there is peace, once Hitler, Yimach Shemo, and his gang of villains are in Gehenna. We know well the two-faced politics of English governments. Our friends in Washington, too, have little understanding of Zionism and of the idea of a Jewish state in the land of Israel. I do not speak here in despairing, pessimistic spirits, heaven forbid. I am not one to be overly taken with Delilah's flirtations, nor do I lose resolve when she reveals her true face. I know that the master of the universe will fulfill his covenant, and his prophecies have more power than the 1939 British white paper. Still, we must be realistic and not adopt foolish, fantastical hopes. Gemara Nadarim 62a, quote, the honor will eventually come, but the road to redemption will be long and difficult. The question is, how will we hold on to the Jewish masses who are, unfortunately, accustomed to cheap effects and silly sentimentalism? On what can one base an ideology that would enable them to weather all the fluctuations and disappointments? On what? On the Friday night Shalom Aleichem or on Nathan Alterman's Shir HaEmek? The Zionists employed a particular strategy in founding their movement to return to Zion. Herzl, too, is tripped up by this. It is the negative method of returning to Zion. On this view, anti-Semitism is a natural phenomenon, and only the land of Israel can solve the problem. I am basically in partial agreement with this outlook. There exists an eternal hatred for the eternal nation, which neither Sholem Ash's Nazarene nor the Institute of Jewish Affairs will defeat. But this is a faulty ideological basis for such a powerful movement as that which seeks to return to Zion. First, this is an outlook that is foreign to the Anglo-Saxon Jew generally, and to the American Jew specifically, who believes that, notwithstanding various periodic anti-Semitic outbursts, the majority of the American population will not allow itself to be led astray by anti-Semitic demagogues. True, the American Jew knows that social anti-Semitism will always exist, but he does not believe, and I likewise do not believe, in the possibility here of the type of bestial anti-Semitism that can be found in Europe. Especially after Hitler gets his just desserts, anti-Semitism will not assume zoological proportions, despite all the dark forces at work in America. You can agree with him or not. This is, at any rate, the average person's opinion. Listen well to what the American Council for Judaism says. And anyway, Moriah Rabotai, no great ideological movement can be founded upon dread. It is too lowly an emotion to serve as the basis for great ideals and a national movement. Such an ideology and worldview must draw on more elevated sentiments than fear, on love, on moments of spiritual uplift, on a drive toward holiness. To the query of the Haggadah commentators, how did the Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael know that the question in Parshas Bo, and when your children ask you, what do you mean by this right, is that of the wicked son? Whereas the question in Parshas Vaschanan, when in time to come your children ask you, what mean the decrees, laws, and rules of the Almighty has enjoined upon you, is that of the wise son? I always answer that the Mechilta came to this conclusion not based on the questions, but based on the answers given these sons in Parshas Bo and Vaschanan. The two queries are essentially the same. Why do we celebrate the Pesach festival and observe all the mitzvahs connected with the Exodus from Egypt? The answers, however, are distinct. What in truth should a father answer a child who asks about Passover and the Exodus from Egypt? On Passover, the Jews were redeemed from slavery, and they were made freemen. Passover led to the assembly at Mount Sinai and the Theophany. Passover connotes the election of the Jewish people, and so on. Passover established the eternality of the Knesset Yisrael. In a word, min ha'olam ve'ad ha'olam. And indeed, the son of Parshas Vaschanan receives just such an answer. You shall say to your children, quote, you shall say to your children, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Almighty freed us from Egypt, and us he freed from there, that he might take us and give us the land that he had promised an oath to our fathers. Then the Almighty commanded us to observe all these laws, to revere the Almighty our God for our lasting good and for our survival, as is now the case. It will be therefore to our merit before the Almighty our God to observe faithfully this holy suffering. Deuteronomy 6. These words comprise a comprehensive program of Judaism and redemption. What sort of answer does the son asking in Parshas Bo receive? Quote, you shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Almighty, because he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but saved their houses. Exodus 12. In other words, there was once a Pharaoh who pursued the Jews, slaughtered their small children, enslaved the men, and raped the women. There was also an angel of destruction that killed the firstborn of Egypt and sought to slip into Jewish homes as well. But we placed the sign of blood on our houses, so the destroyer passed over them. How would such an explanation of Passover please you? There exists a destroyer, and because of it, we must be Jews. Because he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but saved our houses. If the Torah has instructed us to give such a superficial reply to the son asking the question, presumably he is a wicked son who would not understand a deeper answer like that of Parshas Vaschanan. Therefore, the instruction in the Haggadah is, set his teeth on edge. He would not have been redeemed. Amalekites dwell in the Negev region. See Numbers 13. Why did the Meraglim, the spies, decide to mention the Amalekites first? This is comparable to a child who misbehaved and was trapped as punishment. When one wishes to intimidate him, one reminds him of the strap used to beat him. So too the Amalekites were like a frightful strap for Israel. See Bamidbar Rabbah 16. In the wilderness, who was still a young nation, all of 1 or 2 years old. So it made sense then to use the means generally adopted for disciplining a child. But now, we are a mature people, 2,000 years old. At this stage, we have outgrown the responses directed at the wicked son. We need not be intimidated with dogs or straps. The ideology behind the return to Zion must be founded upon a worldview at the center of which stands the land of Israel. And that is only possible within the framework of Yisrael Sava's Weltanschauung and the seven locks of his head. All of the ingenious arguments put forward by left-wing theoreticians about a mystical connection between the people and the land smack of race theory and were contrived by overstimulated brains that sense their own bankruptcy. The ideology of building the land can only be based upon the ideology of the land's holiness. A Jew who believes in the land's holiness knows, too, the halacha, the second sanctification of the land in the days of Ezra, was, in effect, in its own time and for all time. See Rambam Hilchos Truma 1, chapter 1. And so he cannot despair, because, as Isaiah says in chapter 8, for you, O God, are enthroned forever. Your throne endures through the ages. Even if many white papers filled with anti-Semitism seek to shatter the divine throne, they will not prevail. Hatch a plot, it shall be foiled. Agree on action, it shall not succeed, because God is with us. Not only with regard to the spiritual attitude of the Jews, but also when it comes to the Gentiles' position on the question of the land of Israel, the respect and esteem that we expect from the nations of the world. The best salves are the holiness of Israel and the holiness of the land. The seven holy locks of the mighty Samson of the Nazarite's head will alter the Gentiles' relationship with us. Enough allowing ourselves to be seduced by Delilahs and for the price of a couple of compliments, letting the seven locks be shaved. We must learn from the last 6 years of history. We must not be like the Bourbons, about whom Napoleon said that they have learned nothing and forgotten nothing. According to the Rabbinic Agada, when Alexander the Macedonian encountered Simon the Just, he said, "The image of this man's countenance is victorious before me on the battlefield." See Yuma 69a. And all the more so, we Jews must know that only the image of the countenance of Simon the Just, of a Kohen Gadol, of a Yisrael Sava, will be victorious, not that of a Jew who has no relationship with sanctity. But the holiness of the land is not a concept that can be extracted from the full complex of Jewish ideas of sanctity. The holiness of the land is a correlative of the holiness of Israel, the Torah, and the Blessed Holy One. Baba Batra 56b, quote, "One must testify about a full matter, not half a matter." Anyone who needs to be convinced of this should take a look at the present situation, and the Council for Judaism will prove the point. I understand that one of the main goals of this conference is to declare openly that those affiliated with the Council do not speak in the name of the Jewish faith, that, quite the contrary, they deny the fundamental principles of our religion. We will certainly do so. They are obviously renegades and heretics, people who willfully separate themselves from the community. But it is worthwhile to analyze this spiritual anomaly, this psychic ailment. I am no psychiatrist. I am a simple teacher at the Rabbi Isaacson Theological Seminary. However, one must penetrate the souls of the leaders of the council in order to understand the ideological underpinnings that led to such idiotic official declarations. One need not delve deeply into this phenomenon for long. The position of those who hate Zion follows logically from Reform ideology as a whole. There is, heaven forbid, no contradiction between the perverse behavior of the council and the teachings of liberal Jewry. Over here, I guess I have to explain that the Council for Judaism is old classical reform. More modernistic reform has indeed embraced Zionism and the State of Israel enthusiastically. But classical reform, if you would ask Isaac Meir Wise and Kaufman Kohler and the creators of the Pittsburgh platform and the earliest reformers for many, many decades, they would have said, we reject Zionism because Zionism is a desire to return to the land of Israel and to rebuild the land, and that's particularistic. And we are rather universalistic, and we're not into that form of identification. We are liberal Reform Jews who embrace the whole world, and we reject Zionism because it would lead back to Jerusalem, and instead New York is the way to go, and Berlin is the new Jerusalem, and London might be the new Jerusalem, and so on. Those are what the early reformists were saying. Of course, in the very fires of the Holocaust, it was difficult for reformists to continue to say that. And so the Council of Judaism is old-style classical reform, which rejected Zionism. And that's what Rabbi Soloveitchik is talking about. Again, the position of those who hate Zion follows logically from a reform ideology as a whole. There is, heaven forbid, there is no contradiction between the perverse behavior of the council and the teachings of liberal Jewry. If the Torah is not from heaven, if the oral Torah does not exist, if there are no ritual mitzvahs, if intermarriage is permissible, why should one cling to the land of Israel? You might say, because of anti-Semitism. They don't believe in that. They're so wicked that they don't even fear, that they don't even accept the Torah's answer to the wicked son. And they have no fear of their teeth being set on edge. Wealthy Jews support them. The members of the council are faithful to the ideology of liberal Jewry. And I must testify that they are good Reformed clergymen and will merit to eat much Leviathan at the eschatological meal. By contrast, those Reformed clergymen who labor on behalf of Zionism are sinners and will presumably receive lashes in Gehenna. And if you wish to understand how it can be that so many Reformed clergymen are Zionists, let it be known that this is not the fault of Reformed ideology, but of old Mother Sarah, whose milk they have suckled. It may be that Reform's negative Zion ideology can lead to the building of the land. But such an ideology cannot give rise to any proper sort of renaissance in the return to Zion. Converts made by lions are not regarded as converts. See Gemara Yevamos 24b. What makes one a renegade is not arguing against the negative Zion ideology, but rather undermining the holiness of the land, which has its basis in the holiness of Israel. The land of Israel is a component of the ideology of eternity, part of the Min HaOlam Ve'ad HaOlam perspective. Whoever denies that is a renegade. However, I must clarify something, and I emphasize that this clarification is made in my own name, not in the name of any group or party. I alone am responsible for my speech. I am not one of the acclaimed Jewish leaders possessed of a golden tongue, soaring diction, and rhetorical artistry who, quote, attend upon kings, see Proverbs 22, in a royal palace, see Amos 7. I am no politician, theoretician, or orator. I'm a provincial rabbi from Boston and a teacher and yeshiva dean at the Rabbi Isaac O'Connor Theological Seminary. You can say to me, as Amatzia said to Amos, seer, off with you to the land of Judah. Earn your living there and do your prophesying there. See Amos chapter 7. Teacher, go back to yeshiva and give your shiurim there. But don't ever prophesy again at Bethel, for it's a king's sanctuary in a royal palace. See Amos 7. Stop speaking nonsensically at a great political conference. Indeed, I have on occasion invoked Amos's response. Quote, I'm not a prophet, and I'm not a prophet's son. I'm a cattle breeder and a tender of sycamore figs. See Amos chapter 7. I am an idler, and I am a denizen of the base medrash, who is at times rather naive and chutzpahdik. I'm a cattle breeder and a tender of sycamore figs, not a party chairman, not even a rabbinic leader. Still, sometimes a cattle breeder and a tender of sycamore figs from the rocky Judean hills can see somewhat further and more clearly than the elegant aesthetes of royal Bethel. We are protesting against those who hate Zion, and we are declaring them renegades. However, I maintain that even one who affirms the value of the land of Israel but denies the Torah of Moses, the ritual mitzvahs and providence, is also a renegade. No matter how holy, exalted, beloved, and precious the land of Israel might be to us, all of Messianic belief is tightly bound to the land of Israel. It obviously does not atone for heresy and reform. There can be no land of Israel without the oral Torah and traditions, and there can be no love of Zion. I'm sorry, and no love of Zion can be cultivated without love of the tradition. It's true that Reformed Jews who still affirm the value of the land of Israel are considered like the dead of the land of Israel. and the latter can readily be resurrected with the due of resuscitation, while the dead of the diaspora will have to roll through tunnels for decades. And who knows, perhaps those Reformed Jews who campaign on behalf of the land of Israel will have a greater opportunity for tshuva than the renegades of the council, who will be forced to experience the full purgatory reserved for the dead of the diaspora. But the dead of the land of Israel are still dead so long as the dew of resuscitation has not resurrected them. And as such, they still cause spiritual defilements. I see that some members of the audience are starting to get a bit nervous and are thinking to themselves, who knows what sort of nonsense he is about to spew. Fear not, Jews. I am no scoundrel, and I'm not about to ask that we exclude Reformed Jews from Zionism. The Mizrahi would not follow me if I were to demand it. No one would go along with the Mizrahi if it were to propose it, and I do not wish to request it. I wish only to say, as a teacher from Chaslovichi, and that's where he was raised, that Reformed clergymen should not think of themselves as the representatives of the Jewish religion and Torah. If Zionist Reformed clergymen can speak in the name of Judaism on behalf of the land of Israel, then a group like the Council for Judaism can come along and advocate the opposite. If tefillin, tzitzis, and other ritual mitzvahs are not to be found in the Shema, and if the Shema itself is simply an empty monotheistic declaration, then who is to say that the land of Israel is included therein? Apostle says, these are uncircumcised, and those are uncircumcised. These grow plates, and those grow plates. These wear mixed fibers, and those wear mixed fibers. Tiva Yikra Rabbah 23. Why distinguish? And I don't mean to suggest that Reformed clergymen should abandon their lucrative positions in the temples and start dealing in mezuzahs or even certifying cheese as kosher. I wish only to stress that if the return to Zion is important to them, let them preach it in their temples at their Sunday services, not among Orthodox Jews. We don't need liberal Jewry to give the land of Israel its kosher stamp of approval. In truth, however, there are many Reformed clergymen who are afraid even to mention the word Zion in their temples. There sit the money magnates, haters of Zion, who can run them out of town with great fanfare. If these same Reformed clergymen come to the yarmulke-bearing Jews to lecture them about the land of Israel, we have no need of that. Second, I wish to state, and this is the most important thing, that the main political organizations that operate at the national level and the Zionist organization above all must know and remember that, quote, beyond the desert, expansive neath the skies, God has a dominion that vast and spacious lies. See, Meitei Midbar Achronim, in Kol Shirei Bialik. The Judaism does not consist exclusively of licorice sweet reform and semi-reform ideologies. Rather, there is a vast and spacious world of Judaism, of thousands of years of tradition, and this is where the future of Judaism lies. Those who represent the tradition are the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people. It makes no difference whether they make 10,000 a year or 10. The Reform and semi-Reform rabbinate is not an authority by our lights. We have our own Torah sages. No matter how honorably a given Reformed clergyman might behave in his temple, the body of Reformed clergymen will never be recognized, even by so-called Reformed Jews, as a rabbinate, as a high rabbinic court. Gemara Pesachim, the Jews, if they're not prophets, then they're the sons of prophets. And the thoughtless ways in which the Zionist organization relates to Orthodox Jewry in general and to the Orthodox rabbinate in particular is detrimental to the interests of the land of Israel. The political Zionist organization must know that we are ready to do anything for the sake of the land of Israel, but at the same time, it must recognize that we're not attendants or handmaids. When they need a show of yarmulkes, beards, and captains, they call upon the Orthodox. We don't seek merely to perfunctorily be accorded the honor of reciting a Yehi Ratzon before the opening of a conference. Let the Reformed clergymen recite the Yehi Ratzon. The whole ceremony of opening a conference with a prayer is a Gentile one. Above all, last page, above all, the national parties must understand they have to respect the Torah and Jewish law. At Zionist conferences, no non-kosher food should be served, and Shabbos should be strictly observed. When a guest arrives in town, they should host a kosher banquet as a matter of course. That simply is a favor to the local rabbi. In a word, Orthodoxy is fighting for the land of Israel. It should not be treated like the son of his despised wife. See Deuteronomy 21. The responsibility for leading the fight lies with the Mizrahi. The Mizrahi is the only Orthodox party that can gather around itself a respectable, organized Orthodoxy. Already at the 1939 convention in Atlantic City, I stated that the Mizrahi organization must become a powerful instrument, not only for the building of the land, but also for the building of the nation. For we find ourselves faced with Acharam's question, what happens, quote, if the nation is destroyed. The Mizrahi must be the great Orthodox party that represents the interests of Yisrael Sava with dignity. And if this is true in 1939, before the destruction, how much more so today, when the parchment has been consumed, but the letters fly free and must be rescued. Neither the Jewish radicals nor the formalistic Hebraists will save the historical Jew, Yisrael Sava, from destruction. Only Torah true Jews and the tradition will do so. Great and expansive will be Orthodoxy's work in all areas. First, as the efforts to save the Jewish survivors are being organized on a mass scale, and the question is especially relevant now, given the establishment of the Rescue Committee, the War Refugee Board by the President, Orthodoxy must ensure that it occupies a prominent position. Not only is this our obligation in a time of distress, but the rescue of the body will go hand in hand with the rescue of the soul, and whoever saves the body will hold sway over the soul as well. As the old saying goes, whose bread I eat, his song I sing. Second, Orthodoxy must intensify its cultural work. It is not now the time to discuss this question, but much can be done. Too much poison is being disseminated on the Jewish street. Third, conquer the communities. Synagogues are falling into the hands of boors and ignoramuses. The rabbinate is sinking lower and lower. This issue must be seriously studied. In a word, we have to prepare new parchment to receive the letters from the burned Torah scrolls, letters which are already now knocking at our door. This cannot be accomplished at a conference via declarations and resolutions. Rather, this is a long process involving difficult labor and organized efforts, day in and day out. There is no royal road to Judaism, just as, to quote Euclid, there is no royal road to geometry. It's a difficult path, a long journey, but one that is ultimately short. See Erevin 53b. Yisrael Sava must be saved and must exist, not in ghettos, but in a vast free land. Orthodoxy's task is to rescue the letters of the Torah scrolls that are now being incinerated together with the Rabbi Hanina ben Taradion's. Last paragraph. Take a census of the whole Israelite community. Count not those who are no longer. Count those who have survived. And count not in a spirit of despair, but with fortitude and courage. Count them and lift up their heads. Su, all Israelites able to bear arms, all those who can prosecute God's war, who can fight for the survival of the nation in body and spirit, who behave like the Jews in the temple, who don't say, King of Ha'olam of my world, whether that is the world of reform, semi-reform, or plain non-Orthodox clergymen, but rather, Min Ha'olam Ve'ad Ha'olam, from Sinai to the end of days. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining me. Shmuel Plotzker signing off. Hope you enjoyed. God willing, next week we'll do The Letters of Creation, Jewish Axioms and Education in America, an address delivered in October 1944. Have a good day. Like is it, we'll see you tomorrow night. It's not Tuesday at 7:30. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.